John Holloway is a Baroque violin specialist, not only as an outstanding performer, but as a scholar, researcher, and an overall advocate for the instrument, the music written for it, and the musicians who played it. John Holloway, thank you very much for making time to speak with me.
It's great to be with you.
I want to go back to the beginning, and I want to ask you how you started in music as a child, and then later sort of how you became interested in Baroque violin very specifically.
Oh, my goodness. I had an uncle who played the violin, and apparently, I mean, I'm retailing family legend now, I don't remember this, but apparently I asked for a violin when I was three, and they said, not yet, your hands are too small. And so I asked again when I was four. And in those days, it wasn't so easy to get the, you know, the really, really tiny kind of eighth size instruments that you can now get. And so I had to wait until I was five. And then they got me a little violin. And that's when I started. And I was extremely lucky that the where we lived in South Wales, there was a local violin teacher who was willing to come by kind of three, four, five times a week for short lessons. And so just about everything that I did at the beginning stages was kind of overseen by a good teacher, you know, little individual sessions. And so the beginning was very good. And that was, of course, you know, that was conventional violin. That was nothing to do with Baroque specialism or anything like that. And then the next big thing, I guess, was that there was a family friend, a very distinguished violinist and teacher called Ifra Niemann. And so it was inevitable that when the whole thing became more serious, that I would go and study with him. And that finally came about when I was nine. And with Ifra, I stayed until I was 21, all the way through all those difficult teenage years. And then eventually the Guildhall School of Music in London, where he was the senior violin professor. And so, you know, the equivalent of a sort of undergraduate and master's program there. And then I had a phase of doing international competitions and, you know, all the sort of stuff that comes at reasonably talented young violinists. And it wasn't, in fact, until I'd finished studying and was working in London as a freelance violinist that I heard the great Belgian Baroque violinist Sigiswald Kuyken play. He came to England to teach a workshop, I think it was 1972, and a friend of mine and I, a harpsichordist, a friend of mine and I went and listened. And I just sat in a corner and listened to this man teaching, and then he played a concert. And it was like the kind of light on the road to Damascus or something. It was one of those life-changing experiences. I just fell in love with the sound of the instrument. But I was also deeply impressed with how he taught, because it was so much to do with what kind of music is this, and what do we know about the music, and what can we find out about how it was used at the time it was written, and what it might be about altogether. So it was much less about, you know, what can I do to it, and much more about what does this music in combination with this instrument say to us now. And that that was all a kind of completely fascinating experience. It had almost nothing to do with the kind of old-fashioned style of however well-meant dictatorial mainstream teaching that people like me, people of my generation, experienced. You know, it goes like this. Because I say so, was more the norm. And somebody who comes and asks questions and stimulates the student to find things out for himself. What can we find out about, you know, what a Baroque dance was? What were the bowings? What were the kind of characters of dances, for example? And that was completely new territory for me, and fascinating and very exciting. And then there was a period where I did both. I was concertmaster for an opera company that was conducted by Roger Norrington, and we did everything from Monteverdi to Benjamin Britten and beyond. And once the whole early music thing got going in Britain in the early 70s, Roger was saying, come on, we have to do Monteverdi with the right instruments. And then, yes, it all picked up from there.
So I think many people see someone playing a violin and they really don't know the difference between a conventional violin and a Baroque violin. So I'm wondering if you would sort of explain how the instruments compare so that people really understand what you're saying when you talk about taking a turn over into this different instrument.
Well, the Baroque violin is an instrument with much lower string tension than the modern instrument, because the neck is set straight into the body of the instrument in a kind of horizontal line, so the bearing of the strings down on the bridge, and therefore the tension in the stringing, is much lower on a Baroque instrument than on a modern instrument. And when you put that together with the material of the strings themselves, so Baroque violin is strung primarily with gut strings or strings with a gut core, and these are at much lower tension than modern steel or nylon core wound strings. And when you put that together with the tendency today for pitch to go higher and higher and higher, which of course winds the string tension up even more, and when you put that all together with modern bow, which is much longer and heavier and has much more hair in it than a Baroque bow, when you put all of those things together, you're talking about a very dramatic difference in what an instrument wants to do, what it can do, what its strengths are, characteristic strengths. And one of the things that interests me a lot about all this is information that you can put together. If you ask the average person in the street who the most famous violin builder ever was, then most of them will say Stradivarius. If you point out to them, and I do this, of course, to my modern violin students a lot, that Stradivarius, of course, made Baroque violins, because that's what they were then. And so, people tend to get kind of quite curious. And that if you put a Baroque violin by Stradivarius together with the best music being written then by Bach or by Handel or by whoever you choose, then you have a world that belongs together, the music and the instruments. And the extraordinary thing you could say about the developments that have happened since is that 18th century instruments, the great violins, the Guarneri del Gesù or the Stradivariuses, that they modernize extraordinarily well, considering that they were never planned for what is now done to them in terms of very high string tension, in terms of other bridge design, in terms of changed neck angle, in terms of more wood and blocking in order to stand all this high tension. You know, it's a little bit like putting a Formula One racing engine into a roadster. And part of the idea, of course, was to make the instrument simply louder with the development of big public concert halls in the 19th century. But of course, you can't just change one thing. If you change the neck angle in order to increase the string tension, in order to make the instrument louder, you actually change the color of the sound as well. And so what you see is that the priorities become different. I of course, I wouldn't dream of saying better or worse. I just say different.
Well, tell me a little bit about the specific instrument or instruments that you play.
Well, I'm on tour in the U.S. right now. And I have brought with me, a new-made instrument, relatively new, made in 1997 by a young Swiss maker called Christian Zager. And that's a copy of a Tononi instrument from around 1700. And the reason why I brought this with me is a reason which is kind of sadly to do with our times. It has to do with security and airline policy about that. And the fact that I couldn't absolutely 100% trust that if I brought my Ferdinand Galliano, 18th century Italian instrument with me, that I couldn't trust that some security guy wouldn't say, I'm sorry, that's got to go in the hold now. So that's a very modern problem. On the other hand, there is a musical side to it which is quite kind of fun and interesting, which is that we should remember that, especially in the 17th and early 18th centuries, people played overwhelmingly on new instruments. Yeah, there were no 300-year-old violins. And so it's quite an interesting aspect of the situation in which I find myself, that I'm playing on a violin which is about 7 years old, 9 years old, which might be the equivalent of, Bach in Weimar as concertmaster of the court orchestra there, playing on an instrument made in 1700.
So as conscientious as you are about the authenticity of the instrument itself, I know that you're also very conscientious about working from, in this case, in your most recent recording, Bach's actual manuscripts. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Now, we're extremely lucky violinists because the autograph of the sonatas and partitas, I mean, Bach's own autograph hand, reappeared about 100 years ago, having disappeared for most of the 19th century. And there it sits in Berlin, being looked after as best they can, and there are any number of facsimiles of that, facsimile editions. And so we can actually work from a copy of Bach's own handwriting, music writing. And I find this extremely important, not only because it's very beautiful, that although it is, and that is in itself inspiring, he had wonderful music script, but it's also because there are all sorts of small details that are important. And these are details which modern editions tend, even Urtext editions, even modern scholarly editions, tend to obscure. They tend to hide these details because they have to, with a modern print, you have to make a decision. You have to decide, are you going to show the slurs going from here to here or from there to there? You have to decide whether you think that the fact that there's an accidental, a flat or a sharp sign that isn't in front of a given note, did Bach mean it not to be there or did he just forget to write it? And all the modern editions, however respectable they are full of the individual decisions of editors. And I prefer to make my own decisions and to take responsibility for them and maybe to change my mind according to how I react to what Bach left us. And, there are certain things that were changed because Bach's, have been changed by subsequent editors because Bach's harmonizations are sometimes shocking. Or at least shocking enough for subsequent generations for people to think, oh, he can't possibly have meant that, for example. And I prefer to make my own decisions about that and to present them as being, as it were, my opinion and to take responsibility for that. And if you... There have been ages where people are perhaps more confident than we are. When the autograph manuscript reappeared, the person who was asked to make the first real scholastic, historically crucial edition of it was, not surprisingly, Joseph Joachim, who was the great violinist and the great Bach interpreter of the time. And he... So he makes an edition, and he writes in his foreword what a great honor it is to have Bach's own autograph in his hands and to be able to study it very closely and to make an edition which is as true to it as it possibly can be. And in the very next paragraph in this foreword, he writes, of course, there are some unfortunate harmonizations and other weaknesses which we have, of course... felt obliged to correct. Now, nowadays, nobody would do that. But it was indicative of the confidence of the times. And the legacy of this is that certain corrections, heavily in inverted commas, that have been made by honorable people, by serious musicians and serious scholars, but with the... if you like, with the viewpoint of their time. That's what we all do. The viewpoint of my time, or at least my viewpoint, is simply to go back every time, go back to the text, go back to the text, go back to the text. What does it tell me? And obviously, the more I can find out about the context of the text, of the music around, you know, that Bach himself wrote around it, of the music that may have influenced him, certainly the music that was being written and being performed at the time that he was conceiving these works. The more I can know about that, the more when I look at his autograph of these pieces and think, what does that mean? The more there's a chance that I'm going to come up with an answer that has some correspondence to what was going on then, to what a musician then might also have thought.
Can you give me a specific example of some discovery or some little pearl of wisdom or understanding that you have been able to make based on that kind of an observation, based on learning more about the context and then reading the manuscript and really having it coalesce in your mind as a performer?
Yes, I guess there are two. One which is quite a famous one is in the first movement of the G minor sonata, the first movement of the first piece. In about the fourth or fifth measure, there's a place that all violinists know about where the bass note is an E, where Bach writes no flat in front of it. And this is, we have to remember, this is a piece in G minor. In Bach's time, the key signature of G minor has only one flat in front of the B, so you have a B flat. And so all the E's, which are often played as flats in G minor, have to be marked individually, because you also have a writing system where the accidentals, the flats and sharp signs, only apply to one note, whereas nowadays they apply for the whole measure. And so this famous bass note E has no accidental in front of it. So therefore, if we read it as it stands, it's an E natural. However, immediately after it, in another voice, there is an E flat marked with a flat. And this collision of, or near collision of E natural in the bass against E flat above it, is for some people who are used to 19th century harmony rather upsetting. And so Joachim, among many others, altered that note. Now, for me, what was critical in a way was looking at Anna Magdalena Bach's copy of this music. That was Bach's wife, second wife, who copied an awful lot of his music. And in her copy, this famous note is also a natural. And so it confirmed something for me that I enjoyed playing as it was anyway, but where later tendencies to try and turn it into something else lose their power, if you like, faced with not only Bach's copy, but also Anna Magdalena Bach's copy. So that was one. And another one which has a very big effect on how the music actually sounds is the lure in the E major partita. Now, when I was growing up, I was taught that the lure in the E major partita was a lyrical slow movement. That was partly based on the idea that a suite had to have a slow movement, didn't it? I mean, you couldn't have all fast things and vigorous things. And it couldn't be the gigue, because that's obviously fast, and it couldn't be the bourrée, because that's also obviously fast in a different way. And it couldn't be the minuets, because they're minuets, and it couldn't be the gavotte, and so on. So the lure got chosen to be the slow movement. And it wasn't until relatively late on that I put together a whole bunch of experiences, for me at any rate. One was doing a lot of Baroque dance programs at a certain point, and therefore working with Baroque dance experts on what the tempi for lure might be, but also what the choreography is, Baroque choreography for lure is. Experiencing that was important, and then putting that together with what we know about French Baroque dance bowings. And when the whole thing comes together, then you suddenly realize that the lure is not a lyrical slow movement, it's a rather vigorous, proud dance. It doesn't have to be very fast, but it does have to have a tremendous swing to it, because it's a dance with a lot of leaps in it, which explains the melodic line in Bach's lure, which starts with an octave jump. And there are a lot of repeated down bows in it, which make gaps in the sound, which can be lots of energetic kind of swing in the sound, because it isn't continuous, it isn't lyrical. in the sort of modern cantabile sense of unbroken sound. And those kind of things are, of course, enthralling, and they make the whole process fascinating forever and ever. I mean, there'll be no end to this. There are some challenges in the fugues where I still don't have complete answers for me. I mean, you know, as it were, answers that satisfy me, not only that I understand what I would like to do, but also that I've solved the purely violinistic technical problem for me of actually doing it. That's another whole area. And the other thing which is absolutely enthralling, I think, is that especially with the Bach sonatas and partitas, is that they present these problems and possibilities, you know, analytical problems in the sense of, you know, how does this fugue work, or how does the counterpoint in this dance work, and that kind of an analysis. And then there's another kind of analysis that says, what sort of music is this, and therefore how might it be supposed to sound? And then there's yet another kind of analysis that says, you know, here am I with a violin in my hand and a bow, and they are, you know, reasonably good approximations of the violin and bow for which Bach wrote this music. What can I do with this bow and this violin to bring to life my understanding of how the music might be supposed to sound? And so there's a whole area of, you know, violin technical analysis, if you like. Here's a problem, how do I solve it on the instrument?
Right. I know, too, that part of your touring this time around, and I think probably most times, includes master classes at these music schools. You're speaking from the Yale School of Music right now. I'm curious to know how some of these concepts are being received, and I'm curious to know, too, what you think of the training in general that's being offered for these aspiring professional musicians. You know, are they getting enough, and are they getting the proper kind of exposure to these concepts that you've been talking about?
I think that's a very good question, and it's very complicated. I think there are lots of young people for whom this is not new. There are lots of young people who are, if I might say so, rather ahead of their teachers on this. And on the other hand, we have to accept that, you know, most people who teach on the basis of some sense of security that they've arrived at conclusions of their own about music, which they believe in enough to be prepared to teach. And if they believe in them enough to be prepared to teach, then it takes very special people to be then flexible enough to adapt those principles and those ideas. And, you know, we've all seen sad examples of extreme anti-opinions expressed about Baroque instruments generally and about this whole approach to interpretation. On the other hand, think that there are a lot of schools where different forms of this are going on very well. You've got, after all, it doesn't have to be on Baroque instruments. It doesn't even have to be on the violin. You can play Bach on the tuba and still have some integrity about what you look for in the music and what you try and express. That isn't the defining thing. It seems to me that the teaching programs that go on, one of the problems, perhaps more in Europe than in the States, is that there's not enough new music being taught, and so there's very much a problem that young people don't experience what it is to play something new. But there, as I say, that's very much more a European problem than an American problem. And in a way, you could say that the challenge for American violin teaching is to remember that there is 400 years of violin literature now, and that it's easy to forget the first 200 and some. And so there are an awful lot of people whose entire experience of 18th century music is Mozart and Bach, not very much of that. And that's it, and no 17th century music whatsoever, so no context or background to their Bach and their Mozart. And then they plunge happily into the 19th century, And there are still, sadly, schools that then stop somewhere around Shostakovich or Bartok, and that was it. And so you have neither the first 100-and-something years of the repertoire nor the last 50. That seems to me to be an issue. Of course, no one can cover 400 years of the literature with equal thoroughness and equal integrity and equal seriousness. No one person can. But I think it's extremely important that we expose young violinists to all of it so that they can explore and choose their areas of emphasis.
Mm-hmm. And not stumble on it by accident in a sense that you did.
Well, yes, you could say that. I'm enjoying very much the way that it's all worked out for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that if we're, you know, as we move into the 21st century, we should hopefully be able to do slightly better than was being done, you know, 40 odd years ago when I was studying.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it was bad. It was just that, you know, there is now more information available. There is now more, there are now more possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that we would acknowledge this. And you know, in a lot of good schools, this is absolutely the case. And perhaps there's another thing that has to be said, and that is that insofar as performance programs are training people for orchestral jobs, the pressure on that part of the program, because of competition for those orchestral jobs, the pressure is brutal. You know, the competition for good orchestral jobs is absolutely brutal, whether in the US or in Germany or where I live or wherever. And so there is a considerable problem here of time and energy and stamina, if you like, for young violin students today, as to how to deal with that. And on the other hand, we have to see that the symphony orchestra is not the only way to go. And surely, indeed, the very, very exciting contemporary music groups that have come and gone in the last 50 years and the whole early music boom are two very good examples of alternative careers or alternative mixes of career, if you like, that don't just assume that playing, you know, one Mozart concerto first movement and one romantic concerto and maybe, you know, a couple of Paganini caprices is enough to make a good violinist.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't.
You have given me also a good jumping off point to ask you another question, although I know in this particular case your focus is on Johann Sebastian Bach, but you have also given quite a bit of attention in your career and in your recordings and research to Heinrich Bieber. And I'm curious to know a little bit about what is special about Heinrich Bieber's music to you.
Two things, two parallel lines with Bieber, I think. One is my first really serious encounter with Bieber had to do with the Rosary Sonatas, the Mystery Sonatas. And that is, they remain for me absolutely fascinating on various levels. One is this whole business of abnormal tunings of the violin. So the Mystery Sonatas, there are 15 sonatas and the famous Passacaglia. And only the first sonata and the Passacaglia are in the standard tuning of the violin, you know, G, D, A, E, going from the bottom up in fifths. And all the other 14 pieces are in other more or less extreme deviant tunings of the instrument. And that is, among other things, I think we have to assume that we can surmise Bieber's intention. One is that the colours that the instrument makes in abnormal tunings are extraordinary. Another is that there are certain chords and double stopping possibilities that are not available in the standard tuning that become available in one or other of these abnormal tunings. And then there's a third where I think, I'm now talking personally for me, the fascinating challenge of playing music which is notated in normal standard notation and it's notated so you play as if the violin were tuned normally. In other words, what you see on the paper and what you hear have little or nothing to do with each other. And that is such a spectacularly wonderful kind of brain-torturing game that it's because we're used to, as we get to know music better, one plays more and more kind of half from memory or maybe completely from memory. And, you know, if you have the notes there, they're just as a kind of security check possibility. But if you allow your mind to wander in this music, you're in disaster land extremely fast. So it's a particular kind of mental virtuosity, which is quite extraordinary. And then there's yet another fascinating aspect, and that is that if you succeed, if you have the whole thing really under control, then a successful performance of the Rosary Sonatas, the audience have no idea how difficult it is, because they just hear this rather extraordinary, extraordinarily coloured violin sound. And the music itself, as music, is quite simple. It has an extraordinary capacity to communicate. I've been playing this music quite a lot now for 15 years and more. Goodness, yes, and more. And the audience reactions are quite extraordinary. It tends to move people almost despite themselves. And I think it's a classic example. It belongs in a category of music where, for example, Schubert songs belong, or some little pieces, early pieces of Mozart, or there are very, very few pieces of this quality where the music, purely musical means, I'm not talking about the weird violin means, but the purely musical means are very simple and uncomplicated, and perhaps because of that, or perhaps because of that combined with the unbelievable concentration involved in playing the things, something goes across to an audience in a way that, in my experience at least, doesn't happen in any other music quite in the same way. So that's the Rosary is fascinating also because of, you know, the beliefs that lie behind them that for us are almost entirely foreign. You know, the uses of the Rosary in the late 17th century, all those things, very, very interesting in itself. And to try and make the imaginative leap into that world interests me a lot. And then there's the other side of Bieber, which is the public side, if you like. We have to remember the Rosary Sonatas were not published by Bieber. We only have them by a kind of miracle of rediscovery. They weren't printed in his time. What was printed was the 1681 book of sonatas, and that's real kind of extrovert, look at me and what can I do with a violin and so on. And that was the book on which Bieber's reputation as a star virtuoso violinist was based. And there we see this kind of a very particular personal melodic gift and a way of making the violin sound spectacular in very particular ways that he was obviously good at playing and good at writing down what he was good at and making coherent music out of it. And so there's a wonderful combination of the spectacular and the lyrical in that music, which makes him... puts him in a very important place on my short list of truly great violinist composers who were good composers and good violinists and could combine their two gifts. And there are not many of those, but he belongs very high up on that list. Incidentally, Bach belongs, somewhere at the top of it for also being a violinist.
So what's next, do you think? What other music, what other composers besides these two wonderful violinist/composers, Bach and Bieber, what do you think you'll explore in the future?
Well, the immediate next project, when I get home from this trip, it's coming up rather alarmingly soon, is the follow-up project for ECM is a CD of Leclerc sonatas. Again, great violinist, great composer for the violin. Different in a way, both from Bach and from, for example, Veracini, which we also visited on the way past, as it were, in the sense that the elegance of, you know, his Frenchness shines through in the elegance of his melodic writing, and he has a wonderful harmonic imagination to go with it. I mean, within the harmonic language of his time, but there are some moments in the sonatas that we've chosen that are harmonically adventurous, but always with a very special kind of French accent. So that's a little bit of a kind of adventure in a slightly different direction. We're doing all sonatas from Opus 5, which is his middle opus. I think it's the best book of violin sonatas by Leclerc. The later ones seem to me to be more concerned with the balance between technical display and sheer musical expression, and musical quality seems to me to tip more in the direction of pure virtuoso display in the later sonatas, and that interests me less. And because I'm blessed with a continuo team from heaven for these projects, the harpsichordist Lars Ulrik Mortensen and the cellist Jaap ter Linden, it seems ridiculous not to do the sonatas that are, first of all, of the highest musical quality, but secondly, that demand the most intense teamwork, that their role is not just accompaniment at all. On the contrary, it's central to the whole thing. The kind of the conversation, the musical conversation, is at its strongest there. So that's the immediate next project in this kind of exploration of violinist composers. I don't know, to be honest, where that might lead. It has a kind of a natural, at some point it has a natural limit. I would love to do sometime, I'd love to record a program that I do a lot in concert, which is the last three big Mozart sonatas for a piano and violin. Again, a composer who played the violin rather well. But I don't know whether and when that will come to pass. There are some other projects which are much more in the direction of ensemble chamber music. We have a 17th century jamboree in the planning for ECM, which will probably be with cornet and dulcian and gamba and lots of rampant continuo and early 17th century Italian kind of party disc.
Sounds great. Well, John Holloway, I am just so grateful for your time and for your eloquent comments. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And good luck on the rest of your tour. And I'm looking forward to hearing this Leclerc.
Thank you so much.